Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay made his first court appearance today to face money laundering and conspiracy charges. His lawyer immediately asked for a new judge to hear the case because the current one contributed to the liberal group MoveOn.org, which the lawyer said is now selling Tom DeLay mugshot T-shirts, something MoveOn.org denies. But after the hearing, Tom DeLay lashed out at Democrats for going after him in court because they couldn't beat him at the ballot box.
In short, I have been charged for defeating Democrats. I have been charged for advocating constitutional representation. And I have been charged for advancing the Republican agenda.
Tom DeLay has his day in court at the end of a week in which the Bush administration tried to do damage control on many fronts, including the nomination of Harriet Myers and the grand jury investigation into whether anyone in the White House leaked the name of undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Judy Keene. She covers the White House for USA Today. Judy, to Tom DeLay first, what kind of political ripples does his appearance in court create?
Look, this White House and this president have never been particularly close to Tom DeLay, but he's been a valuable asset to this administration in terms of keeping things under control on Capitol Hill and moving the president's agenda forward. This is a tough time for the White House, and Tom DeLay's problems are only the latest in a long string of things that have gone wrong for them. They need Tom DeLay up there working their agenda, or they're very worried it'll be stalled.
And remind us, what are the items of the agenda? I think first of Social Security, but there are others that are just completely off the radar.
Yeah, I mean, it's a given, I think, that Social Security reform, at least to the scale that President Bush initially proposed, is not going to happen anytime soon. Bush himself has said that there doesn't seem to be a great appetite for it now. But originally, the White House planned this fall to have a big rollout for its proposal to loosen some immigration rules and have a new guest worker program. That's what they intended to be talking about at this time of the year. And in addition to that, proposals to completely overhaul the tax code, some of which we've now heard. The administration had hoped that those might even be passed into law at the end of this year or early next year. It gets tougher and tougher as the weeks and the months go on because next year is an election year, and it's always harder to get things done in an election year.
Well, you're reporting today that Vice President Dick Cheney is giving pep talks to staffers in the White House. It's a mood there that low.
This White House is exhausted. They feel as though they have faced one crisis after another, not all of them of their own making. And we haven't mentioned the federal response to Hurricane Katrina, which was certainly a setback for this administration. They're exhausted. They feel that all they're doing now is sort of rolling with the punches, trying to break through both with their message and their agenda at a time when people are focused on many other things.
Well, let's get to some of those. An editorial in today's Wall Street Journal called the Harriet Myers nomination a political blunder of the first order. This is a page usually very much in support of the president. Has there been any sense that she might withdraw?
No, and it would be very uncharacteristic of President Bush, who's a very stubborn man, to do so. But if you'll recall, when he first introduced her to the American public and to Washington as his nominee, he said, the more people come to know her, the more they will agree with me that she's an appropriate nominee for this post. In fact, the opposite seems to be happening. The more people get to know Harriet Myers, the more concerned they are that she's not an appropriate nominee.
Well, we want to note as well that today the president is visiting California. He's going to be visiting the Ronald Reagan Library. But it's been reported that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who has some polling popularity problems of his own and has some issues that he's trying to get across to his public, a special election is one of them, that Schwarzenegger does not want to meet with President Bush. One aide saying it would have been nice if President Bush had delayed his visit.
There's always been tension between President Bush and Governor Schwarzenegger, despite the smiling photos of them together that we've seen occasionally.
But how does this reflect on the Republican Party as a whole? Are people distancing themselves from President Bush?
It's hard not to draw that conclusion. I think it's a little too early to say that that's a trend, but as the election nears, it's going to become tougher and tougher for people to fully embrace Bush if he continues to be mired in these many problems.
And Judy Keene will mention one last one before we let you go. Any sense of when any action might happen in the investigation into the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame.
The grand jury that has been hearing testimony in the case expires on October 28th, 1 week from today. It meets on Wednesdays and Fridays, so I think that next Wednesday and next Friday are our target days.
Judy Keene, White House correspondent for USA Today. And this reminder, later in the program, we'll have a profile of special prosecutor in the Valerie Plame case. In San Francisco today, 23-year-old LaShawn Harris is facing murder charges, accused of throwing her three children into the bay. Her family says she's been battling schizophrenia for years and had gone off her medication. Harris said she was heeding the voices in her head. Well, 52-year-old Carolyn Spiro and her twin sister Pamela Spiro Wagner know the devastating toll of schizophrenia and those menacing imaginary voices. They are identical twins. Carolyn, also known as Linny, is a psychiatrist. Pamela, or Pammy, a gifted writer. But Pam is also one of more than 3 million Americans suffering from schizophrenia. The sisters have now chronicled their story in Divided Minds, Twin Sisters and Their Journey Through Schizophrenia, and they join us from a studio in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you.
So our listeners know you each take turns in the book telling the story from your unique vantage point. Identical twins, but completely different views of things. And Pam, I wonder if we can start with you. If I'm reading the book right, it sounds as if the voices that you heard, the whispering people, you call them, first show up in the book when you're about 11 or so. Is that about when you started hearing them?
Yes. Exactly when Kennedy, JFK, was killed, which wasn't the cause of the people. Mostly it was the trigger, the shocking event that brought them into being. But any shocking event could have happened.
We understand that about schizophrenia, that sometimes it's a genetic component, but it takes a shock to the system to sort of unleash
right.
it.
Right.
Well, Pammy, what did the voices say to you?
At first, they were saying my name in various forms, and then they were saying nonsense words, which I tried to counter with thinking nonsense words or thinking the multiplication tables backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. And then in a very strange way, they'd imply that I killed Kennedy. All of this was in nonsense syllables. In like, you know who know, kill her, kill him, kill him, kill her, kill her, kill him. Mm-hmm. And yet I came to understand through all of this that I had killed Kennedy.
Did you tell anyone?
No, I couldn't tell anyone. I'm not sure why.
Who would have believed you, Pam? I mean, why would you tell anyone you were hearing voices and that you killed Kennedy when no one in their right mind would have taking you seriously?
That's Pam's sister, Carolyn. And, you know, Carolyn, I'm wondering, in that same area of the book, you describe your sister Pam, as you saw her, as perfect, you know, perfect in every way. A little jealous of her, you know, a little bit.
Oh, yeah, she was. She seemed to me anyway.
But did you have any sense that anything was wrong?
At that time, absolutely not. I basically thought she was playing up to the adults for attention. If she'd suggested that she'd killed Kennedy, I would have, you know, rolled on the floor thinking this was hilarious.
Well, you both excelled at school. You went on to Brown University. Pammy still living in her private hell until it began to leak out. She couldn't hide it anymore. Linny, as Pammy got older, what did you see?
Well, you know, in the beginning of the more obvious stages, she didn't dress very well. She was disheveled. Didn't communicate very much with most of the family, was quite paranoid a lot of the time. Many of the family members didn't know how to communicate with her. I think it probably was easier on both parts often to just keep their distance.
She's chain smoking, she's living in squalor.
Yes, that's true. People were disappointed. She probably felt, I don't know, Pammy, did you feel that you were letting people down?
Your description of me in the book appalled me. I had no idea
how bad thing you looked.
That you saw me as a bag lady, essentially, that you didn't recognize me in the hospital. I had no idea I smelled or that I was so disheveled.
And Pam, I'm wondering, too, you speak about five people who monitor your movements. You write about how people on television are monitoring you. There's the crinkly gray paper.
It's gray crinkled paper, and it has to be spoken like that. It's not gray, it's not crinkled, and it's not paper. It's gray crinkled paper, and it's the secret to the universe. It's the secret to world peace. It's the secret to the universe. And it's the message that I have to translate for the world. Lenny, what is it?
I mean, the truth is it's a delusion. It's Pammy's brain misfiring in I'll oversimplify it, but it's a misfiring circuit in her brain that gives her this sense of certainty and knowledge about something that is not true.
Pammy, do you remember what you might have felt like before all the hard work you've done, the hospitalizations? Do you remember what you might have thought if someone told you there is no such thing? That doesn't make sense, gray crinkle paper.
Oh, absolutely. I can get back into gray crinkled paper in a heartbeat. It's only when Lenny reminds me step by step, word by word, what she means by delusion, and reminds me how it's a delusion and why, that I remember, oh, gray crinkled paper isn't real. It isn't real. It's just a delusion. That I can remember that and not get caught up in it.
But you just said something important. So you can go back into that place.
Basically, when you asked me about gray crinkled paper, I was back talking about gray crinkled paper with all the belief in it that there ever was.
Actually, Robin, I would say it's more remarkable that she can stop it all now and say, oh, yes, now wait a minute. This is that thing that Lenny says is actually not real. There are a lot of ups and downs. Every time you think things are going to be stable for a while, she would stop medication, and I understood why, because the side effects were so bad. She'd stop the medication and end up back in the hospital in terrible, terrible shape. But in the last 6 months, on a new combination of medications, she has become a new person. She has just blossomed. It's unbelievable how good she's become. So that it's true. I start to have hope that maybe we're actually seeing, if not a cure, perhaps a long-term possibly a permanent remission. It's unbelievable to me.
Pammy, do you feel that you're in a remission?
Oh, I'm absolutely in a remission. I mean, I went to a hotel. I went to a restaurant. I just got wanded today at a metal detector, which I've been terrified might happen if I went through a metal detector, which I've avoided completely by never going anywhere. I've never been to a hotel. A restaurant? Are you kidding?
Yeah, we've got a whole new book to write about how we've gotten her to do all these new things.
That's Carolyn or Lenny Spiro talking about a possible sequel to Divided Minds, Twin Sisters and Their Journey Through Schizophrenia. Carolyn co-authored the book with her sister Pammy. When we come back, though, we'll ask Pammy about the bad times, how bad it got, and how the love of a twin pulled her through. Stay with us. Much more ahead, coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been speaking with Pamela Spiro Wagner and Carolyn Spiro about their fiercely honest memoir, Divided Minds, Twin Sisters and Their Journey Through Schizophrenia, compelling reading. And there's much in the book about the support and the failures of the medical health system and medicine. But Pam, as you know, a major study recently found that new, more expensive schizophrenia medications are generally no more effective than older generic drugs. But you found a drug combination that you say has finally helped. Isn't that true?
Well, I'll tell you, I take two antipsychotics, one of the new ones, one of the old ones. I take three anticonvulsants, and I take a whole host of other ones for various reasons. But and that basically leaves me like a bowl of raw wood. basically put together, but not anything more than a bowl of splinters. And then I started taking a drug for narcolepsy, which if you've read the book, you know I also have. But this drug has basically polished off the bowl so that I'm now, you can eat off me, you can wash me, you can do anything you want to me.
And maybe change the metaphor.
Well, you can change the metaphor any way you want. But basically, all the rough edges have been polished so that I'm as good a bowl as you are. And I think this drug has been knitting together everything that was just raw before.
It sounds, just a terrific place right now. But Carolyn, I want to also just ask you how hard it was along the way. Pammy alluded to the fact that she tried to overdose. At another point, voices are telling her to take Drano. Lenny, you're on the phone with some health workers trying to find Pammy, trying to stop her. And there's a point where it seems as if, Pammy, you're exhausted from trying to live with this disease, in part for your sister. And Lenny, you're exhausted with trying to keep your sister from dying.
Alive.
Yeah, alive.
Well, it was hard. There were definitely times that I wondered if I had any right to keep insisting that she go on. She would be desperate to want to end her life, want to stop going into the hospital, want me to just stop calling, leave her alone, stop insisting that she take her medication, and want me to give up on her. And I just simply refused to give up. I just said to myself, essentially, either she'll ignore me and she won't be around someday and I won't be able to do anything about it, or someday she'll thank me for not giving up.
Oh, yes, I will, because you got me to this place.
But at that one point, Lenny, I mean, you would say to Pammy, you can't kill yourself because you'll murder me too.
Right. And I have said that to her on any number of occasions. That
unfair.
I've said that I will pull out all the stops, that you simply cannot do that to me.
And Pammy, can you explain how hard it is? You know, at one point, you on the phone say to Lenny, I know you want me to live, but, you know, I can't. I can't hold on. Why?
Yeah.
It was so hard?
I had basically lost all hope that anything would change. I couldn't read. I couldn't write. I had no pleasure in anything. I had no hope for the future. I had nothing in the present. And my sense of the past was that the past was nothing but wasted. So I had no future, no present, or no past. And all I could see was that it was going to continue just as it had.
So what did I tell you? Told you to borrow mine.
Hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one thing a twin can give you.
Yeah. And people all through my life have given me hope when I've lost hope. Somebody or other has maintained hope for me when I've lost hope. So I'm lucky in that sense.
Pamela, you also had something that was uniquely yours. You can write. And in 1993, you got one of your first prizes for an article you wrote about health insurance coverage for the mentally ill. At the awards presentation, you read a poem.
It's called To Forgive Is... And essentially, it's to forgive is to begin. But I wrote it at a time when I was estranged from my family. And I was trying basically to forgive them, to forgive myself, to forgive my family.
Let's listen.
When you have forgiven whatever is of earth, of sky, of water, whatever is named, whatever remains nameless, forgive, finally, your own sorry self, clothed in temporary flesh, the breath and blood of you already dying. Dying, forgiven, now you begin.
Pamela Spiro reading from her poem. And Pam, one last question for you. I'm wondering, when you say forgive yourself, how hard it is to look across from you and see the mirror image, the person you might have been, because she's your identical twin.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I'm glad for her. I'm happy for her. She's saved me so often. She's been a wonderful friend.
And you've been a wonderful friend to me, too.
Yeah.
So.
We adore each other.
You know, this illness has, in spite of the suffering it's brought, it's actually, I hate to say it, but it's also enriched our lives in ways that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily have wanted, but one could never have predicted either.
And it brought us closer, I think, than we ever would have been.
So
that's both of us talking.
Yes, it's true.
Well, it was a delight to speak with you. Pamela Spiro Wagner, Carolyn Spiro, authors of Divided Minds, Twin Sisters and Their Journey Through Schizophrenia. They spoke to us from New York. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, thank you for having us. I thought Carolyn would speak for both of us.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Patrick J. Fitzgerald is the top federal prosecutor in Chicago, but these days he has all of Washington holding its breath because he is also the special counsel investigating the scandal that has become known as Plamegate. Fitzgerald has said he will announce findings next week, and while there's been a lot of speculation about whether he will issue any indictments, he somehow managed to keep Washington guessing what his next step will be. So who is Patrick Fitzgerald? Joining us on the line, a man who knows him well and also happens to have a lot of experience operating under the lights of a high-profile Washington scandal. Robert Ray was the special prosecutor who took over for Ken Starr in the Whitewater Lewinsky scandals. Robert, thanks for joining us. And when did you work with Patrick Fitzgerald?
He and I were assistant United States attorneys together in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York in Manhattan during the late 80s and early to mid-1990s.
And what kind of a lawyer is he? We've read people refer to him as a Boy Scout, a straight shooter, the Elliot Ness of his genre. What's your take?
Well, he's dogged and relentless. He's extraordinarily bright. He has a great sense of humor. But he's, you know, he's a committed public servant. He's trying to get at the facts, and I've found him to be responsible, which is to say that while he, you know, won't leave any stone unturned in an effort to try to uncover all there is to uncover, ultimately he understands that one has to make a judgment based upon what you found, and that may mean that you bring a prosecution. It may mean that you don't have sufficient evidence, and you decide that you don't.
Yeah.
So he's a straight shooter. I mean, I think in short, in addition to the fact that people have, you know, certainly characterized him as aggressive, and I think that's probably fair. You want prosecutors to be aggressive. At the end of the day, though, you also want them to be both aggressive and fair.
Well, let's get to the point that both sides of the aisle are wondering about. We're reading that Patrick Fitzgerald may be the only apolitical person left in the country. I mean, in this political season, is it possible that he is apolitical?
When you do the job of a prosecutor, I think you're certainly making a great effort because it is so important, given the tools that you wield, to make decisions that are perceived, both because it's so and because it's important that the public comes to accept them as so, based upon the merits and not based upon politics. Political prosecutions have no place, and it's a great commitment both of the Department of Justice and of federal prosecutors generally, that cases are brought based upon the merits, not because of, you know, which political party they may have been affiliated with or who appointed them to office.
But I mean, you worked alongside him at times. I mean, did he talk politics? Because people are saying they absolutely had no idea what his politics were.
I don't. I still don't. I mean, I'm rather friendly with him. I don't know what his politics are. I mean, obviously, he's an appointee of President Bush. He was recommended for the position by then Senator Peter Fitzgerald in Illinois, a Republican. But he was recommended and filled the position because of his integrity and forthrightness and the fact that he's a very capable career prosecutor, not because of his party affiliation.
Yeah. Do you think he has aspirations for higher office, as people are saying of Eliot Spitzer in New York?
I think he's more fairly characterized as apolitical.
Hmm. We're talking to Robert Ray. He's the former special prosecutor in the Whitewater-Lewinsky scandal, and we're learning about Patrick J. Fitzgerald, who's the special counsel in the Valerie Plame case, currently being investigated. Bob, are you surprised at how Fitzgerald has been able to keep this investigation under wraps? And what is Washington saying about the way he's, you know, the fact that he is doing that?
A prosecutor under these circumstances is professionally obligated to keep the investigation under wraps. I mean, there are rules that federal prosecutors are required to follow, and that would include Pat Fitzgerald just like any other federal prosecutor, and that is the grand jury material is secret. He can't talk about it, and there should not be leaks from his office about what is occurring before the grand jury. I think that both he has recognized, and frankly the President of the United States has appreciated, the fact that he's handled matters discreetly. That's important for a number of reasons. One, if you decide not to bring charges, obviously leaking things into the public arena potentially causes great damage to the reputations of the people involved, which would be unfair. Mm-hmm. And second, if you decide to bring a prosecution, those sorts of leaks could seriously hamper the ability to successfully prosecute that case or case later on. So there's good reason to not talk about the investigation as it unfolds.
But you have said that you took a very different tact. You announced things when you took over for Ken Starr and the Lewinsky investigation. You gave interviews, talked about what people were doing so that there was an expectation of what was coming. Is that just because they were completely different cases, or?
Well, the times were different, too, and I think, you know, there's an aspect of investigating the President of the United States that is somewhat unusual and distinct from what's going on here. This is at a high level within the White House, but it is not, after all, an investigation of the president. And second, while I felt free to talk about certain things as far as timing and whatnot, you do have some sense of timing here. I mean, wherever the information came from, it seems fairly certain that we're going to come to a conclusion here probably next week. Those sorts of things you can talk about. What you can't talk about are matters that actually are occurring before the grand jury, which seems to be the great public interest right now. I would not have felt any more free to talk about matters occurring before the grand jury during the course of my investigation, and didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what he's doing here. He's not talking about what people are saying before his grand jury because he's not permitted to do so.
Robert Ray, as a former special prosecutor, you know better than anyone what might happen after whatever happens next, whether there are indictments or a full report. We don't know what's going to happen. I'm guessing that those who don't agree with him will vilify him, and those who do will make him a hero.
Well, we've lived through that environment. I certainly did during the period of time when the independent counsel statute was in place. I hope that that's not the case here. I suppose that whoever is on the receiving end of a potential prosecution may find it in their interest, as is often the case in high-profile prosecutions, to attack the prosecutor because it seems to be in their interest. The one thing that's different this time, I would suggest to you, is given the fact that Patrick Fitzgerald is an appointee of then Attorney General John Ashcroft, and obviously as part of the Ashcroft and Bush Justice Department, an appointee of the president. The president here, unlike in the recent past, if not having spoken highly of Pat Fitzgerald, certainly has respected his space and ability to, you know, take a look at the facts and render an appropriate judgment. And the president has withheld judgment, and I think that also speaks well of the president under the circumstances to allow this investigation to run its course without interference.
Robert Ray, former special prosecutor in the Whitewater-Lewinsky scandal. He worked with Patrick Fitzgerald, who is the special counsel investigating the Valerie Plame case, for 6 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, and he's now in private practice in New Jersey. Bob Ray, thanks for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome.
And still to come, Oscar winner Charlize Theron. She stars in the new film North Country. It's about the first ever class action sexual harassment suit in the U.S. We'll speak to her and the movie's director, Nikki Caro. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, the World Series starts tomorrow night in Chicago with the American League winners, the White Sox, taking on the National League's Houston Astros. The White Sox burdened by history because they haven't won a World Series since 1918. And then there was that little matter of 1919 when the team's legacy was tarnished by the Black Sox scandal when some of their players conspired to fix the World Series in favor of the Cincinnati Reds. We'll see a few placards about that this weekend, I'm sure. The Astros' burden not nearly so heavy. This is their first ever World Series, but they have not been around as long as Chicago has. They do have some aging players who might not have another chance to win the title, so a lot of pressure there. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, is with us now to preview the series. Welcome.
Thank you.
I just have to say it again. What happened here? No Red Sox. I can't. Okay.
Well, there are lots of people who think that's just fine. No Red Sox, yes, no Yankees, clean slate, let's go.
Hard to imagine. And I know you like this matchup. Give us a reason to pay attention.
Well, I think the primary reason is you've got two baseball teams that have really earned their way to the World Series.
What are
and
you
been
saying?
Great fun to watch. Chicago had a magnificent season going until the very sort of the last month and a half, and then they went into a terrible tailspin. Mm-hmm. It looked like they were going to have the worst collapse in the history of the regular season, blow a 15-game lead. They recovered, and they played brilliantly through the playoffs. And the Astros beat St. Louis, which most people didn't think they would do. And their pitching has been absolutely extraordinary, as has the pitching for Chicago. So it should just be a great matchup.
Well, and, you know, watching as a, again, I have to say it, Red Sox fan, I was astonished. I know the Astros are, what, 44 years old, something like that. They've only been around. The
right.
team. But I just assumed.
I thought you were talking about Roger Clemens.
Well, I assumed with Roger Clemens they'd won somewhere. But no, talk about the pitching.
Well, you know, you've got former Yankees, and of course, Clemens can former
everything.
Whatever you like, you know, Blue Jay, Red Sox, and so on. But it's a staff that's been put together over time. It's kind of all matured together. And the only staff in baseball better is the Chicago one that pitched four complete games in a row, which is unprecedented in this day and age, where the common wisdom in baseball is no team can win without several good setup men and a terrific closer. Well, if your starter is going to throw a complete game, you can throw that sort of analysis right out the window.
So what do you think? Do you think this is Rogers' last hurrah, and do you think it'll be a good one?
I don't think anybody should ever say this is Rogers' last hurrah. It's Dan Duquette said that how many years ago, and people are still throwing it up at him whenever they see him.
Red
and
Sox,
all he's done is win about three Cy Young awards since
Red
then.
Sox manager who traded away Roger Clemens and now has to watch.
Right.
But what do you think? Will it go seven? Will a wild card team win another World Series? That would be the Astros.
Well, you always hope that a series will go seven because that gives it the chance to develop all the delicious subplots mm-hmm. that make watching a series such fun. As far as the wild card team, gee, I think by the time a team reaches the World Series, that wild card designation probably is irrelevant. They've mm-hmm. beaten two other teams that have won in their divisions. It really doesn't matter. And I think one consequence of getting this far is both of these teams are going to come in terrifically mm-hmm. confident that they can finish the job.
Well, wild card teams have won the last three championships. I know that because you told me.
Mm-hmm.
Before we let you go, I noticed you have your do-rag on. I want to comment on the new NBA dress code. What do you think about that? And explain it.
My favorite irony about the NBA dress code, which says, among other things, no sunglasses inside, no sleeveless shirts. It also says no. You can't go out without socks. You must wear socks under your shoes or sneakers. And, of course, it's no socks weekend in Houston as we speak because the Astros don't want socks.
Oh,
you see?
That's great.
So none of those people in Houston who aren't wearing socks would pass the NBA dress code, and that is about how silly the NBA dress code is.
Yeah, it's an attempt to get a business casual look for the team's team-related events. Some say it might be racist because of some of the clothing, but we'll put that aside for a second because I do want to ask you in the few seconds we have. Patriots linebacker Tenney Bruschi had a stroke just last winter.
Mm-hmm.
He's been cleared to practice. He may play as soon as next weekend. What do you think?
Well, he's made a decision, and numbers of doctors have endorsed his decision, and one just hopes that he will not get hurt any badly than NFL players always get hurt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, good on him. I wish him the best.
And some of us will hold our breath. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Don't forget, listen to all of his sports opinions this weekend on the show. As always, Bill, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Robin.
Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New Zealand director Nikki Caro made waves in 2002 with her independent film Whale Rider. The film told the story of a young Maori girl's struggle to prove herself to her tribe, her grandfather, and herself. Today, Caro's new Hollywood movie, North Country, opens in American theaters. North Country is based on the first-ever class-action sexual harassment lawsuit in the U.S. Producer Andrea Shea spoke with Nikki Caro and the film star Charlize Theron in, we should note, often colorful language, about North Country.
North Country is set in the Mesabi Iron Range of Minnesota. Visually, it's stunning. The big sky and vast drifts of snow and ore contrast with the dark, airless feeling down in the mines. It's there that the film's most offensive scenes take place. North Country is inspired by the book Class Action, the landmark case that changed sexual harassment law. A group of women miners filed that suit in 1988. They fought their mining company for 10 years. The movie dramatizes their struggle against tradition.
You got no business being here, and you damn well know it. But you're not hearing that, are you? So let's try something new. How about work hard, keep your mouth shut, and take it like a man?
For the women miners, taking it like a man meant putting up with relentless sexual harassment. Director Nikki Caro says she was shocked by the story when she read the script.
And I was equally shocked and impressed that a studio had the balls to tell it. I couldn't believe it as a studio film. And I thought that if it was made well, that it could really be something.
For Caro, making it well meant making it real. Like Whale Rider, North Country examines the legacy of sexism in an isolated community. Both films were shot in small rural towns. The director also cast locals as actors and extras. Caro says she approaches her feature filmmaking as she would a documentary.
I spend a lot of time with the real community, and I try to find out everything about them, you know, how they dress, how they treat each other, what they listen to, the food they eat, so I can inform all the characters really, really honestly.
A lot of the times it felt like we were just kind of living this life instead of kind of making a film about this life.
Academy Award-winning actress Charlize Theron stars in North Country. She says she was determined to work with Caro after seeing Whale Rider.
I remember seeing it and just being blown away by how she approached that film, how she approached that story, how she approached Keisha, who was, I think, 13 at the time. And I wanted some of that, so I kind of started stalking her.
New Zealand native Keisha Castle-Hughes earned an Oscar nomination for her role in Caro's film.
My name is Pakea Apirana, and I come from a long line of chiefs stretching all the way back to the Wild Rider.
Eventually, Theron had lunch with Caro and
the rest is the history that I like very much.
Theron landed the lead role of Josie Ames in North Country. Her character's arc is harrowing. The film cuts between the past and the present. The narrative starts when Josie flees an abusive marriage. With nothing and nowhere to go, Josie moves back home with her stoic parents. Desperate for independence, Josie gets a job at the ironworks where her father and just about every other man in the community works. Then the real drama begins.
Pop, we got a house. We got the loan and everything.
Well, will you congratulate you?
You act like I'm stealing. I work damn hard every day, same as you.
Oh, now you're the same as me.
Oh, no. There's a few differences. You don't go to work scared of what they're going to write about you on the walls or what kind of disgusting thing you might find in your locker. You don't got to be scared that one of these days you'll come to work and get right.
Josie's father, played by 6 feet under actor Richard Jenkins, isn't sympathetic, and it's painful to watch the two interact. He, like the other male miners, are threatened by their female co-workers. Theron says his reaction is dictated by survival and tradition.
Grandfather, father, brother, uncle, they all worked in the mines, and that was just kind of how it was.
The women miners broke that cycle, and a new cycle took over. What starts as locker room humor quickly evolves into all-out sexual harassment. After months of catcalls, filthy innuendo, and incessant groping, Josie takes a stand against the abuse. North Country then shifts into civil action meets the accused meets Silkwood mode. You can even catch glimpses of the Anita Hill hearings playing in the background throughout the film. But Theron says Josie is different than Hill and the film characters who've come before. This makes Josie more difficult to read.
She wasn't your quintessential Norma Rae or Erin Brockovich, who had this great personality about her, who was feisty, who was a ball buster, who just kind of went in there and changed things. And if you saw her in a room, you'd go, yeah, well, that person I can see really changing things. She wasn't that character.
Josie's character is more naive than Rae or Brockovich. She's a victim who takes care of herself almost reluctantly because no one else will.
I know some of you here think I want to shut down the mine.
And don't worry, sweetheart. We're not going to let it happen.
I don't want to shut down the mine. I just want to go to work like everyone else. Get paid end of the week, feed my kids, and hell, maybe now and then have enough left for a beer at TG Saturday night. And not a woman in that back row don't know what I'm talking about.
The landmark sexual harassment trial was settled only 7 years ago. Director Nikki Caro says things have improved in the Iron Range since then, but there's still a long way to go.
Because that's life and that's human nature and that's generations of people in a very remote place. And it will take generations still for those notions to change.
Some might be tempted to pigeonhole Caro as a women's filmmaker or a feminist. Both Whale Rider and North Country feature women leads struggling to fit into male-dominated cultures. But Caro doesn't see herself that way. She says the movies she makes and some others today simply tell stories that haven't been told.
Those are the unusual films now. Those are the interesting characters and the places that haven't been explored because we're used to guys being the lead in films, and we're used to women being in the supporting roles. And it's very kind of healthy for me to make this film where there are so many great female roles and also wonderful male actors supporting them in character roles.
Woody Harrelson is one of those male actors. He plays the lawyer who considers Josie's case in North Country.
The illusion is that all your problems are solved in the courtroom. The reality is that even when you win, you don't win.
I know, but I'm right.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you are, but right has nothing to do with the real world. Look at Anita Hill, because she's you.
You think you're outgunned at the mine. Wait till you get to a courtroom. It's called the nuts and sluts defense. You're either nuts and you imagine it, or you're a slut and you ask for it. Either way, it's not pleasant.
On the whole, North Country isn't a pleasant film. It's brutal at times, but it's also about strength and survival. I asked Theron if she thought Caro brought something unique to the film as a woman director.
The only thing that really made her, being a woman, really incredibly powerful in this film was that the women who had experienced this, who became our consultants on the film, felt very safe with her, incredibly safe with her. And I think that was incredibly important. And maybe that wouldn't have happened with a man. Who knows?
Caro says she learned a lot making North Country, not just about Middle America and the groundbreaking trial, but also about herself as an independent filmmaker turned Hollywood director.
Well, I learned, this is funny, I learned that I was good.
With North Country, Caro proves she can handle a big budget and an impressive cast. But still, she says Hollywood isn't her ultimate destination. The New Zealand filmmaker says she'll go wherever the drama is, whether that's back home or somewhere as foreign to her as the iron mines of northern Minnesota.
Producer Andrea Shea, she spoke to director Nikki Caro and actress Charlize Theron about North Country. The film opens today in theaters nationwide. You can find a review on our website, here-now.org. And Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young, and apparently I've mixed up my sock drawer. Earlier I said the White Sox last won the World Series in 1918. That, of course, would have been the Red Sox win. The White Sox won in 1917. Either way, it's been a long time. Have a great weekend. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.